From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a rare look into the private world of therapy. First, from the urban setting of New York, we talk with Paul Solotaroff, a former editor at The Village Voice. He followed the progress of six people in group therapy over a year for his new book, Group, Six People in Search of a Life. Then we meet Michael Roseman, a psychologist specializing in helping farmers get through rough times. Sometimes he sees them in his office, but just as often he counsels them while standing in their field. He says today's economy is threatening the family farm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Los Angeles police have fanned out across a city suburb looking for a middle-aged white man dressed in green. The suspect, who burst into a Jewish community center late this morning and opened fire, wounding five people, three of them children. NPR's Andy Bowers has more.
A man police describe as a white male, about 40 years old, walked into the North Valley Jewish Community Center a little before 11 a.m. Apparently, without saying anything, the man opened fire with a small-caliber weapon, perhaps police say an Uzi submachine gun. Police were on the scene in a matter of minutes, but the gunman escaped and is still at large. Wounded in the attack were three young boys, a teenage girl, and a 68-year-old woman. One of the boys, a 5-year-old, has been undergoing surgery, and doctors say he's in critical condition. A manhunt is currently underway in the northern San Fernando Valley area of Los Angeles. Police are also searching a red van found in the area, which reports say may contain boxes of ammunition. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Granada Hills, California.
President Clinton deplored the shootings, calling them an act of senseless violence.
Once again, our nation has been shaken and our hearts torn by an act of gun violence. To the victims and their families, like all Americans, I offer our thoughts and prayers. I have been briefed on the situation on the ground. The federal government has offered all appropriate assistance to the local law enforcement officials who are working on this case.
The president says today's incident is more proof that the nation needs tighter gun control laws. A district court in Georgia, judges in Georgia, is hearing testimony in the case of a 15-year-old boy accused of wounding six high school students during a shootout at Heritage High School in Conyers, Georgia last May. At issue is whether T.J. Solomon should be tried as an adult. Regulators in Arizona say they'll take a close look at stock day traders. That after a recently issued national report found that some trading firms mislead many traders. Mark Moran of member station KJZZ in Phoenix has more.
The State Corporation Commission, which oversees stock trading activities in Arizona, says it will investigate day traders who sell huge volumes of stock every day, trying to profit on even small increases in share prices. But the National Securities Administrators Association is considering banning some of the traders' most often used lending practices. In Arizona, regulators say they'll look into day trading activities by conducting field inspections in an attempt to protect people who are being lured by firms to get into the day trading business. Arizona officials say firms often don't disclose all the risks involved in becoming a day trader, and they want to change that. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. Cycling champion Lance Armstrong was at the White House today to highlight new strides against cancer. Armstrong came back from cancer to win this year's Tour de France race. He listened as Vice President Al Gore announced new figures on cancer survival. The National Cancer Institute says a record 8.4 million Americans have beaten the disease. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is urging India and Pakistan to use restraint. That after India shot down a Pakistani surveillance plane, killing all 16 people on board. Pakistan calls it an act of unprovoked aggression, while India insists the aircraft invaded its airspace. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
A single missile from an Indian fighter jet brought down the French-built naval surveillance aircraft Tuesday morning near India's western border state of Gujarat. India says the plane had strayed into its territory. Pakistan has denied that claim, saying India's action amounts to cold-blooded murder. Pakistan's foreign minister, Sartaj Aziz, said his country reserved the right to make an appropriate response. Some media reports indicate that the plane crashed in a marsh where the border between Pakistan and India is difficult to mark out. A large military buildup is being reported on both sides of the border. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
The United States will not modify its patrols of no-fly zones in Iraq to accommodate astronomers and others who want to watch tomorrow's solar eclipse. The Pentagon says if Iraqis don't want to be attacked, they can simply stop challenging Allied planes patrolling the no-fly zones. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. One of the mechanisms that allows therapy to work is its confidentiality. It helps to create a safe space in which people can share their most intimate experiences. It's unusual to have a journalist taking notes and tape recording a group therapy session, so my guest Paul Solotaroff's new book is a rare look into a private world. Group, Six People in Search of a Life, documents the intimacies, drama, frustrations, and changes he witnessed among six New Yorkers during their year of group therapy. Solotaroff sat several feet away from this circle of people, trying not to make noise or to have an effect on what was going on. Paul Solotaroff was no stranger to group therapy. He had spent 2 years working out his own problems in a group led by the same psychiatrist.
I had been laboring with a fairly severe case of panic disorder for about 11, 12 years, the onset of which coincided with my last semester of college. That's not unusual. Often the precipitating event in panic is a life change of fairly substantive order. And 11 years later, I had lost about 40 pounds. I had drifted in and out of graduate programs from city to city, and was having a pretty lousy time. I somehow had wound up through a series of left turns as the sports editor at the Village Voice, where I was even money to have a panic episode every closing day, which was Monday, and being seen by a therapist who was lovely and effective, except she didn't know the first thing about panic. And finally she sent me to the guy who's made such a substantive difference in my life.
Well, you were able to get to the right therapist that you profile in this book, and he was able to put you on the right medication. And as you write about it, that really took care of the panic attacks, but I guess it didn't take care of the sort of residual fallout of 10 years of anxiety and stress.
Anxiety, stress, and loss. When you lose 10 years, in my case, I lost the better half of my 20s and 30s, it's a very heavy bite. And I had to come to terms with the fallout of those 10 years in absentia. And so he made clear to me fairly early in our relationship that he was forming a group of panic sufferers, people who were extremely effective in their professional lives and utterly kind of terror-stricken outside of that. And the group started soon thereafter, about a month or two later, and it was the most extraordinary experience I've ever participated in.
Well, this may be an unfair question, but in a nutshell, how did group therapy help you?
Well, first of all, the sight of those four or five other people in the chairs next to me or across the room was an enormously comforting one. You can be told by a therapist that your condition is actually quite common, but to hear it coming out of the mouths of others, other adaptive and sensitive and intelligent people who suffer from precisely the same kinds of neurochemical a malfunction that you do is really orienting and stabilizing in a way that's hard to express. The other thing is that as I heard the effect of the condition on the lives of these other people, I became much clearer on the subtler ways I'd been affected. And but bottom line, it was the sight of us getting better together. Mm-hmm. It was the sight of us really kind of emerging as ourselves in the course of that year and a half or 2 years. Going from this, you know, these five or six tightly clenched people who were living as close to alone as it's possible to, while still being in a marriage or still holding a job, to people really in possession of their confidence and all of their humanity and their dignity. And by the end of that 2 years, our lives had been radically transformed.
What made you then want to write this book and take readers inside a therapy session? Was it to sort of resurrect or shed some light on what you think is potentially a positive, although, of course, very difficult interaction?
Well, again, there are a number of answers, but the most trenchant one is that those stories are so powerful. It's that whole notion of change and change over a prescribed period of time that I found enormously kind of seductive. And when I went back to the therapist to talk to him about a book and found out that he was about to assemble a group even more kind of verbal and self-dramatizing than mine, I was just unable to think of doing anything else.
Well, the leader of this group, I should say that everyone in this book has a pseudonym. The pseudonym for him is Charles Lathan. And curiously, he was your therapist before you became started to write this book. And you write about the sort of awkwardness of having a, quote, post-therapy relationship with your therapist. And I wonder how you work that through. I mean, here's a guy, of course, who knew a lot about you. I don't know how much you knew about him before you started this project.
Yeah. I wound up knowing a lot more about him than I cared to, as a matter of fact. But that was much later. It was very awkward. He did know me the bottom of my bones, and what was so powerful about him, aside from his kind of lucid intelligence, was the fact that he was highly effective at putting the wall up, and it was a very kind of intriguing wall, because he was an extremely stylish man, extremely bright man, and that kind of curiosity was a very sort of powerful part of the transference. But what complicated matters is that we were not only engaged in a relationship, but a business association. And it was an association that got very complicated as the process went on.
Well, I would say from reading the story, and his style was confrontational. He had a kind of gruff exterior. He didn't show a lot of his so-called or that quote-unquote soft side, and that this was a man who clearly had an ideology and a philosophy, but was very much in control of what was going on and seemed to enjoy the sort of power of leading a group.
Mm. If there's any word that describes his affect in the room, it is authority.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very large man, a very physically imposing character, and his intelligence is outsize. And you were aware of this kind of dominant presence in the room, even when he went a half hour or 45 minutes without saying anything. But when he did speak, it was with this power of moral authority.
Mm-hmm.
And what he had to say was extremely canny and thoughtful, but it was also bracing. He didn't spare feelings at any time, in fact. part of his power consisted of his willingness to inflict pain, to bring front and center the thing being avoided, or the thing being denied, resisted. And once he did it, it became very hard to avoid or resist it.
Help us understand how he ran a group, and maybe it's unfair to even ask the kind of philosophy that he had, whether he was, you know, more Freudian than he was Jungian or Rogerian or all those various psychological philosophies. But I mean, he seemed to be partially didactic. He was teaching people about, you know, how emotions work and how people work, and then obviously confrontationally therapeutic at the same time.
Yeah. He was this odd combination of, as you say, the didact and the empath, and he did a lot of, you know, on the job training, and the training that he tried to impart and succeeded in at least a couple of cases was what I like to think of as adult therapy. As he says on several occasions in the book, most of the people who came to him, who come to him, are functionally unparented, meaning that whatever it is they're supposed to learn about being adults from their mothers and fathers did not come through. And so they were there as much to learn about how an adult makes judgments, conducts himself or herself, discharges his or her responsibilities, as they were to, you know, kind of unpack their history. In fact, he was less interested in the history than he was in the ways in which people did and did not function as adults in the here and now.
So there wasn't a lot of going back to early childhood traumas, so to speak.
It probably took up, 20% of the actual talk time in group. Mostly what group consisted of was a very rigorous inspection of the way people were behaving right now, the ways they were destroying themselves at work, or the ways that they were handicapping themselves at home. These six people, I should say, are extreme examples of the New York winner type, all of them highly effective, highly functional characters in their professional lives, three or four of them quite famous, in fact, and for the most part, utter disasters at home, making, you know, a wreck of their marriages, of their parenting, of their relations with their own parents, and that was what got most of the attention.
Well, these were six people in a group. Again, they all have pseudonyms, but one's a magazine editor, former model. One is a Wall Street whiz kid, as you say. One a former rock and roll musician, problems with alcohol. One works for children's rights. One is an accountant, and the other a former Broadway producer, each of them having, of course, the drama of their lives. What do you think they had in common?
Well, I think what they mainly had in common was that they had to act and act now or go off the cliff. They had all arrived at a point in their lives when it was either change or die. And if not die, then lose everything. Three of the people in the group had already lost everything, either through addictions or through a series of atrocious judgments. Had made utter shrift of extremely successful careers and were now teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, teetering on the verge of overdose. And it was that kind of psychodynamic pressure that made that year in group so enormously evocative and effective. I've sat in on groups where that kind of do-or-die stake was not in effect. And, you know, the outcomes are very different. And what he did that I thought was so effective with this group was populated with these six people, none of whom could afford to take a session off.
My guest is Paul Solotaroff, author of Group, Six People in Search of a Life. More on group therapy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Paul Solotaroff and his observations watching six New Yorkers in group therapy. The group seemed to be run as a series of monologues where one of the participants would talk about their life and then with sort of follow-up Q&A sessions, the very intense Q&A sessions where either Latham himself or some of the other participants would ask and ask and ask and ask.
Yeah, actually, what he designed the group to be was a series of these, as you say, monologues. So mm-hmm. if the group ran 2.5 hours, you'd get three, perhaps four of these, not monologues, but interrogations.
Yeah.
One person would sit in the hot seat, be interviewed by another person in group. At the end of 20 minutes or so, the group would then take over and begin to interrogate the witness, as it were, mm-hmm. and you know, it got awfully thick in there. The transference on the part of the listeners was pretty severe. So, for instance, if Rex, the 31-year-old whiz kid on Wall Street, was talking about stalking his stripper girlfriend while his beautiful blonde wife was in hospital about to deliver their first child, then Lena, the child rights advocate who was being very badly abused by her own husband and was trying to divorce him, got furious at him and began to take him on for his derelictions of responsibility. And those were very highly charged sessions. And there was screaming, there was tears, a lot of laughter.
Yeah. But
a lot of that laughter was laughter in a graveyard.
Did you notice things like body language and who sat next to whom and who made eye contact with whom and who crossed their legs when so-and-so spoke up?
Sure. And what I paid close attention to were alliances that formed, these kind of natural pairs, six people, and it did seem as though there were three kind of, you know, couples or dyads, even though there are four men and two women. It did seem as though at the end of the day, each of these people was really talking to one other person in that room. And that one other person for them evoked a mother or a father, evoked a sibling that they hadn't spoken to in 20 years, evoked in a couple of cases some earlier version of themselves. An example, Rex, the Wall Street wunderkind, was a kind of before picture of Jack, the 60-year-old ex-Broadway producer. Both of them were extremely handsome, extremely charming, extremely seductive characters. And Rex was Jack before he'd lost everything. And so each of these guys looked across the room and saw the road taken, or in Rex's case, the road about to be taken. And it was very, very powerful.
One of the participants, a person you call Dylan, and he's the musician, recovering alcoholic. He had a very serious drinking problem. In fact, dropped out of the group or didn't come to a number of sessions early on. How did the group handle that?
The group's instinct was to give him some leash, but not a mile. And when he disappeared after the first three or four sessions, the initial reaction of the others was solicitude. I think they were very concerned about him and afraid. When he fell very hard. This is a guy who had been enormously successful writer of TV and film scores after about a 12 or 13 year career as a rock and roll sideman, playing with bands like the Doobie Brothers and being on tour for most of his 20s and early 30s. And when he fell, he was a guy who drank a case of beer at a sitting. Mm. And he drank it slowly and methodically. And I know that because I sat with him at bars in his horrible apartment way the hell over on 11th Avenue, watching him drink himself into a stupor. And when he came back, the first time there was a certain amount of forgiveness and discretion. He dropped out three times. Right. And each of his disappearances was more and more disruptive. And by the second time, the group was ready to dropkick him. And Lathan urged them to forbear and forbear. And it became a very divisive issue as the year transpired.
Although you do write that by, and again, you know, without giving too much of the story away, that by the middle to the end of the session, that Dylan comes back and tries to work very hard to make up for the lost time of the early portion of the group.
Yes, he does. In fact, when Dylan comes back, group begins in January, ends in December, and when Dylan comes back in September after the long summer break and stuns these five other people, not only by showing up, but also by being alive. It had been widely assumed that he was dead or that he was living on a bench in Port Authority. He worked as hard, if not harder, than anybody in that room to make up for lost time and to earn himself, a place in the graces of these five other people.
Paul Solotaroff's book is Group, Six People in Search of a Life. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at VISX.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the final sessions of group therapy. We continue our conversation with Paul Solotaroff, who traced the progress of six New Yorkers in therapy over a year. Then we turn to Michael Roseman on counseling farmers during rough times.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with Paul Solotaroff. He spent a year observing six New Yorkers in group therapy and witnessed the frustrations and breakthroughs that can happen in an intense psychological encounter. His book is Group, Six People in Search of a Life. When did you begin to see some changes? And, each of these people came with their own story and had their own dramas to deal with within the session. But at what point did you begin to see that these personalities were beginning to move off that space they had occupied so hard?
Well, as I said, there were these three sort of couples in the group, not acknowledged and certainly not acted upon in any kind of, romantic or substantive way. But the first two people in the group who really began to kind of emerge from this sort of husk of suffering and paralysis, the accountant Peter and Lena, the children's rights activist, really began to kind of turn up as themselves or as versions, as truer versions of themselves by about the summer. You began to see them acting in very kind of dramatic ways to kind of reconfigure their lives. Lena had been trying for 2.5 years to divorce herself from an extremely wealthy man who was using the legal process to destroy her. Financially, very wealthy, she was not, and he was trying to break her. And the group really kind of empowered her to take the fight on and not be this kind of whipping girl for this sort of wealthy thug. By the end of the summer, the other two who really kind of emerge as winners in this group began to kind of get it. And one of the things you see in group is that there's a lot of measuring going on. There's a lot of comparing. Generally, there are two or three people who really kind of lead the way in terms of their ability and their willingness to get going. And it's their momentum, it's their seriousness that brings the others along. And as group makes clear, not everybody, makes it in the winner's circle. Of these six people, it's probably fair to say that four come out significantly ahead of where they started, and that two don't. And those are pretty good odds.
What was the last session like? A series of therapy sessions that went for a prescribed period of time. It wasn't endless group therapy.
That's right. One of the things that Latham did to ensure that these sessions were as packed, as intense, as crowded as they were, was to set a clock. Mm-hmm. And the clock was this limited number of sessions. It started out as 20 for detailed reasons wound up at 25. But each member knew that he or she had a prescribed period of time to get well or get out. And that last session, which ran over 3 hours, was an extraordinary piece of theater in which everything that had not been said got said that night. Animuses, jealousies, empathies that had been implicit were very much made explicit that night. And the big surprise of the evening was the way the group took on the therapist with their own dissatisfactions and score settling. And it was a night that I don't think I'll ever forget.
It's interesting because was that planned, do you think, by the group? Do you think they had been secretly talking about the therapist, or was there something just spontaneous about this last session and perhaps the first person turning to Lathan? And they did take him on. They really went after him.
Yeah, they laid him out.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't planned. In fact, it was, you know, just a couple of, you know, sort of stray comments that opened the door to this sort of outpouring of, I don't know, hurt, frustration.
Mm-hmm. What did they accuse him of?
Of not paying attention, of proselytizing, of making the making the sessions half tutorial and half therapy, of demagoguing, of hogging the airwaves. He was a guy who had a lot to say, and unfortunately, often granted himself the space in which to say it. And in limited time, you know, it not only breaks momentum, but it also, you know, monopolizes time that's needed by these other six people. And they let him know it.
Yeah, and how did he take it?
He took it hard.
He
also took it to heart. But what they were responding to was more than simply design errors or errors of egotism. And one of the things that comes across very kind of vividly in the book is Lathan's grandiosity. They were also expressing their profound unease with the changes that occur in him over the year. And those changes are very sudden, very shocking, and had to do with the way he dressed, radical change of environs. He moved from this wonderful office in the West Village to this very grandiose gallery that looked like a kind of you know, coronation of himself. And
complete with his own sculptures that he'd made, right?
His own sculpture and his own paintings,
yeah.
Which was an extreme lapse of judgment on his part. These paintings of his were very revealing and distracting, and the group let him know it in that last session.
He had been your therapist. Do you think lesser of him now, or do you just feel like you have a more complete picture of who you were dealing with?
Well, I do have a more complete picture, and I'm not sure I'm grateful for that. As I say, part of his power derived from his inscrutability. I mean, this is a guy who dressed all in black, was this kind of towering physical presence in the room, and part of his moral authority was the impermeability of his own persona. You were dying to know more about him, and a lot of our, you know, post-session gab fests had to do with speculation about his sex life and about his, you know, his recreational activities. And so, by betraying more of himself, his quotidian, private self to these people, I think he did kind of demythologize himself in ways that were not adaptive, that were not useful.
Watching this group for a year, did it make you want to go back into group therapy?
It made me never want to set foot in a room
Is that right?
with a therapist again.
You're cured, eh?
It made me want to write my next book about flowers or about fruit, about something without a set of lawyers, without a set of pathologies. Yeah, I mean, you know, sure, that kind of, you know, sort of momentum and narrative is, and also community. You know, I mean, that group, in spite of the fact that they didn't, you know, trade numbers and go see movies and ball games together, was for those 2.5 hours extremely intimate with one another. And that kind of intimacy is what so many of us dearly seek and feel so sorely lacking in our lives. So, yeah, there was a kind of ambivalence. But this experience, this 4.5-year journey, was so torturous for me that it's not something that I wish to to repeat in any form now or in the immediate future.
Well, Paul Solotaroff, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
Paul Solotaroff is the author of Group, Six People in Search of a Life. Coming up, Counseling Farm Families. This is Fresh Air. This summer has been hard on the nation's farmers. In the east, the drought has stunted many crops, and unless there's a lot of rain soon, there won't be much of a harvest this year. In the Midwest, the prices for livestock, corn, and beans have dropped dramatically, which could ruin many farmers, some of whom are working land that's been in the family for generations. My guest, Dr. Michael Roseman, is a fourth-generation farmer who raises cattle in Harlan, Iowa. He's also a clinical psychologist whose practice is made up of farmers and their families. They come to him for help in dealing with the uncertainties of today's farm economy. Roseman is also the director of the Sharing Help Awareness United Network. That's an organization that provides support to families who experience an injury or even death due to a farm accident. I asked Michael Roseman to describe the ways that stress tends to show up in farm families.
It does typically follow a pattern. Often, the symptoms begin to show up in the form of increased apprehension and anxiety to begin with. The farmer and other persons in the family may have a foreboding sense that the prices or the crop yields or both aren't going to be sufficient to cover the expenses. Often that anxiety begins to merge into a sense of depression, a sense of almost helplessness in the face of factors that they can't control. We often see problems develop with insomnia, sometimes with psychosomatic outbreak of symptoms that reflect stress. In some instances, persons may withdraw from their usual social endeavors. They may, in some instances, verbalize their own plight to other farmers, but often they don't say very much to persons who are outside of the farming occupation.
Do you see farmers with panic attacks? I mean, does the anxiety get to that level where they really are in this heightened state of anxiety?
Yes, that's actually a common occurrence where a telephone call may trigger a panic reaction for fear that it is a creditor or a banker who is calling to inquire about the farming operation. In some instances, persons become almost paralyzed and unable to check the mailbox for fear that they may find a letter or a notice that they don't wish to receive.
Do you see more drinking, problems with drinking?
That's interesting. We do see more persons turning to alcohol and other substance misuse. Sometimes we see cocaine and amphetamines as the substances that are misused in rural areas and on the farm. And it's interesting why that occurs. They're harder to detect, whereas alcohol shows very obvious signs, and it's easily detectable through breathalyzers and so forth. But cocaine and amphetamines are more difficult to detect, and sometimes they give a farmer who is under stress the kind of boost that he or she thinks they need in order to keep operating the machinery during long hours. So substance abuse does increase. But it is not usually the primary symptom. The primary symptom is typically interpersonal discord or anxiety or depression.
As you talk about these problems that farmers have been having, I'm thinking about how different that is from many of the problems that would bring someone to a psychologist's office, many of Yes. those problems being a kind of external problem. Maybe you didn't feel that you were loved enough as a child. What you're talking about are really external problems, problems out of people's control.
That is a very keen perception, and it's accurate, because most farmers do not have serious chronic mental health issues. These are typically situational. They're brought about by stresses at the times, usually economic, or in some instances, you know, there may be pressures from lenders and so forth that we'd call social stressors. But we don't see people with psychotic illnesses who are also farming much, because persons with these type of debilitating mental health issues have been sorted out. People with personality issues seldom are engaged in farming. I've yet to see a person with borderline personality disorder who's also farming.
It'd be pretty hard to be a farmer, wouldn't it, with borderline personality disorder?
Well, I would think so.
Yeah. So you're talking about healthy people in crisis, essentially.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you help a farmer, I guess, get over that initial reluctance to seek help, especially seek the help of a psychologist?
It's important that the farmer feel that he or she can talk to someone who understands the operation of the farm. Farmers will talk to other farmers. They will also talk to professionals who understand farming, and I should say ranching, because basically when I refer to farmers, I'm also referring to any person who's in the food production system. It's important for farmers and ranchers to feel that they are understood, and often there is an immediate bond by talking with a psychologist or social worker or psychiatrist who grew up on the farm or who may be living on the farm at the present time. It saves a lot of groundwork, so to speak. It isn't always imperative, but it helps to break down the barriers that in many cases keep people from seeking help.
If you're invited then or go out to a farm, a ranch, to talk to a farmer, we'll say, in crisis, what, you might stand in his field with him or perhaps go someplace on the farm that's quiet and comfortable and familiar?
Yes, we'll do it on his terms. Whatever is going to help that person feel a sense of privacy and maybe allow for conditions to help him verbalize what's troubling him.
Do you find in doing therapy with farmers and ranchers that you then need different kind of metaphors, different kind of language to be able to communicate?
Yes, we do. Sometimes we use the language that is common in the area. You know, we may use a term to identify mother pigs giving birth. We call that farrowing.
Uh-huh.
And when I say, well, you know, how's the farrowing average this spring or this summer? Immediately, the person who's raising hogs knows what's going on, and they know that, you know, I am familiar with that at least. I grew up raising hogs, so it's something I'm comfortable with.
So you can speak this common language?
Yes.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is psychologist and cattle farmer Dr. Michael Roseman. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is psychologist and cattle farmer, Dr. Michael Roseman. I would think as a psychologist, if you're talking about problems outside of anyone's control at this point, whether it's the farm prices or the weather, that there's really a limit to how much help you can give somebody.
I think it's important to distinguish what are the causes of the problems and who controls them from who has the control over the solutions. While farmers may not have a great deal of control over the causes of the farming disaster, we may have some control over how we respond to it. For example, we still can talk with one another instead of isolating ourselves. We can band together to figure out maybe if we can pool our efforts to keep the farm operation going. It's possible for us in some instances to organize a number of people and to talk about the farm problem, or maybe to write Congress people, or maybe to write a letter that expresses the needs of a number of people to have a better market in the area, or maybe to encourage economic development in the community. These facts or these approaches give hope to persons who otherwise feel that they're unable to control the factors that affect their farming operation.
Does it also give them a sense that they are not alone in this problem?
Very much. Very much so. And that's so important, because when one feels that his problem or her problem is perceived and recognized by others, it helps to break down the sense of isolation, the sense of I'm having to take all this burden by myself. It's important to share the common experience, mm-hmm. and that's a bond. So I think that we do not have full understanding from many persons who affect the price of food. For example, many farmers feel frustrated that consumers do not fully recognize the depths of the problem in the farm economy. There's also some perception that maybe certain government officials do not fully appreciate the difficulties with the farm economy. So it is important that farmers band together with others who have a common understanding, a common experience, and may also have some knowledge of what can be done to solve the problem.
Farming is a very dangerous occupation, perhaps one of the most dangerous in the country.
Farming is the most dangerous major occupation in our country.
You lost a foot or part of a foot to a farming accident.
Oh, I caught my foot in an auger in a combine and lost three toes on my right foot. It was a powerful lesson.
What happened?
Well, on July 28th, 1990, we were starting to combine oats. There were a few soybeans in the hopper from the previous year, and I wanted to get the soybeans out of the hopper so that the oats that we were combining would be free of any foreign matter, and soybeans in this case would be, foreign matter. So I crawled into the hopper and pushed the remaining soybeans into the auger. I asked my helper to start the auger and unload them, and there was one little dab of beans that were still down by the auger, and I pushed my foot toward them, and it all happened in a second. My foot started going up the auger, and I must have jerked my foot out with great force, because I tore the heavy Vibram lug sole from the bottom of my shoe completely off my shoe.
So you...
And then the front of my foot was missing.
So it was instantly just cut off right there?
Right there. I knew instantaneously what was going on and what the message was for me. The very first impression was when I saw the front of my shoe missing, or the remainder of my shoe, I thought, oh, a few stitches and I can keep going. The next instantaneous thought was, uh-oh, it's worse than that. Mm-hmm. And then the next immediate sensation was, oh, God, I know what you're trying to tell me. And I jumped out of the hopper and I was on the ground in 2 seconds. And then it took several weeks and months for the whole lesson to sink in.
What was the lesson that you learned?
There were several. One lesson was to not try to do too much, but to pace myself and to take time to recreate, to slow down, to think clearly and carefully. Another lesson was to examine my motives for doing things. I felt there was a need to get my life centered, to become more spiritual in my commitment, to understand that there is a higher power that has control over me and my livelihood.
You raise cattle now. Did you find that relieve some of the stress of working as a therapist?
It certainly does. I like my cows very much, and they seem to like me. And it's fun to be around cattle. We have an understanding. They don't talk back. We work together. I depend on them. They depend on me. And I like physical labor. I like it when I can throw hay bales. It's a great release for me. It helps me to clear my own mind. I can even meditate while I'm undertaking physical labor or working on the tractor.
Michael Roseman, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Michael Roseman is a cattle farmer and clinical psychologist in Harlan, Iowa. Today's senior producer was Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer was Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Research provided by Sam Adams. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Darkness Peering by Alice Blanchard, a psychological thriller debut, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Dan Hedaya on preparing for his role as President Nixon in the new comedy Dick, and Randy Wayne White on his off-the-beaten-track adventures. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.